It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, for the first time ever, two northern black widow spiders were identified in Brown County. We'll talk to the expert who ID'd these spiders about this and other spider news.
First, there's been one breaking news story after another in Washington, D.C. this past week. Questions remain about the role President Trump may have played in helping craft Donald Trump Jr.'s misleading statement about his meeting with a Russian lawyer.
The White House is also implicated in a retracted Fox News story about the death of a former Democratic National Committee staffer.
Sabrina Siddiqui joins us now. She's a political reporter for Guardian U.S., and she's based in Washington, D.C. Sabrina, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, the White House confirmed this week that the president did weigh in on a misleading statement from Donald Trump Jr. about a meeting with a Russian lawyer. Now, you spoke to an ethics lawyer about what all this entails. So what did they say?
Well, I think that what experts said in terms of the legality of the president's involvement in crafting this statement on his son's behalf is there is nothing illegal about misleading the American public or lying to the media, as it was clear that the White House did with that initial statement that explained away Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russians at Trump Tower in June of 2016 as having to do with adoptions. We know that later it was because they were offered incriminating information about Hillary Clinton. What this does do, however, is it places the president squarely in the midst of something that is going to be a key moment for federal investigators as they examine Russian interference in the U.S. election and whether there was possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow. And I think that what experts said is we still don't know if Trump, the president, knew about the Russian interference or what he knew when he knew it about this particular meeting that's been a big subject of scrutiny. But he certainly now has potentially obstructed justice by misleading on the messaging around that meeting.
And does it make a difference if the president weighed in, offered an opinion on that statement versus whether, you know, he dictated it?
That's what seems to be the issue here, is that if he personally dictated it, then he knowingly tried to cover up the true nature of the meeting, or that's what I should say prosecutors will try to prove, that he knowingly tried to cover up the true nature of that meeting. I think you will see the White House try to plead ignorance and say, well, the president genuinely thought that it was about adoptions, and it's essentially his word against, you know, what we saw in those emails. And it's difficult, of course, to prove motive and intent, but I think that that's what would be the big question is, has the president done himself in by suggesting that he had some sort of motive to cover up this meeting, because they kept changing their story about, you know, what the specifics of that meeting was day by day.
And this also seems to put Donald Trump Jr. in a pretty tight spot, because he either has to confirm what his father has said or say something else. So does this sort of box him in?
It does. That's actually the exact words that one of the legal experts I spoke with used, is think about Trump Jr. as a material witness in both the investigation into whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow, because we've now seen these meetings and he was part of his father's campaign. He did accept a meeting where he was being offered what was described to him as highly incriminating information about Hillary Clinton that was sensitive information as well, being provided by the Russian government. Whether or not he got that information, we don't know, but he showed a willingness to collude. Now we also have in the question of whether or not there's been obstruction of justice, the fact that Trump Jr. has to either, as you said, he has to either testify under oath that what his father put out as the initial rationale for this meeting is true, or he has to directly contradict it. And in later days, in the press, he certainly contradicted it. It puts him in a really difficult position when he's actually testifying under oath to have a clear story that does not implicate him or his father.
And where does that leave others who might be involved in this evolving story, Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort?
Well, Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner both appeared privately before, Jared Kushner appeared privately before investigators in both the House and the Senate last week, and Paul Manafort has been trying to reach a deal. He certainly has had some private discussions as well. Both the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees are also looking into this question of Russian interference. And I think that they've been smarter because they've been a lot less public about, you know, the nature of their conversations with the Russians and only really offered what they've been compelled to offer, turning over documents to the relevant committees, not saying anything about it in public. And Jared Kushner, you know, one legal expert told me, has been the smartest. He's not giving Robert Mueller, the special counsel, a single morsel, really, to go off of to prove that he was aware of, you know, any of the wrongdoing or any of the more nefarious potential communications that transpired between associates of the campaign and the Russians. He's sort of pled ignorance, and that's what you would want to do, is to make sure that, you know, the prosecutors cannot establish that you were intentionally or willfully helping the Russians, that, you know, at best, maybe you didn't realize that you were being used as a pawn, because you can't really prosecute someone on the basis of ignorance. You have to show that there was the true intent. And so I think both Manafort and Kushner have very much played that game where they're cooperating, they're not saying anything public, they're listening to their lawyer's advice, and they're going to most likely suggest that they were not acting in any willful way, and they had no idea, you know, perhaps what Trump Jr.'s conversations were with the Russians. Maybe I think you'll see them say that they didn't really read the email thread, even though they were, in fact, at some point copied on it.
And in breaking news from today, the president did just sign a bill that levies new sanctions against Russia. Does that somehow change the conversation about the Trump administration's alleged ties to Russia?
Well, it certainly is telling that he signed it. The White House had put out mixed signals, even as members of Congress on both sides of the aisle were overwhelmingly supportive of levying these sanctions. I think North Korea and Iran were a little bit less scrutinized as much as Russia, in part because, as you mentioned, this administration has taken a different posture than its predecessors. And, of course, it's also under the cloud of this investigation. But what was striking was the president's statement today as he signed those sanctions. First of all, you didn't have that ceremonial show of him signing, you know, a bill that he's done with other issues in the past, where he's wanted to make a big show of signing an executive order or a bill to prove that it's some sort of accomplishment. He did it it was a lot quieter, and in the statement, he was very critical of the bill, and he said he believes that Congress is infringing upon his authority, that he knows how to make better deals than Congress. He pointed, as he characteristically does, to his success in business to, in essence, denigrate what it was that lawmakers were trying to achieve here, and even expressed his view that he doesn't think that this is a positive if you're looking at the broader relationship between the U.S. and Russia and his desire to turn a new page. So I think that, you know, he signed it, but publicly he still has not taken a hardline stance against Russia, and his affinity toward Vladimir Putin and Moscow, I think, is something that will at least continue to be part of the conversation, as in the eyes of some, being relevant to the investigation about, you know, what communications may have occurred between Trump's campaign and Russia.
We're talking with Sabrina Siddiqui right now from The Guardian U.S., checking out the top stories out of Washington this week. And Sabrina, another big story, the Senate confirmed Christopher Wray as the new FBI director. The vote was 92-5 yesterday. Tell us about those five no votes.
Well, look, there were a handful of Democrats who voted against the confirmation, and there were some Democrats and progressive groups who believed that the Senate should not have confirmed an FBI director, a successor to James Comey, until there was a vow of some kind from the president that he was going to respect the independence of the FBI and, in essence, make a commitment that he would not fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel, things that we know that Trump wouldn't do. But I think because they're going on recess for August, there are other people who believe that the FBI needs to have a new chief. Christopher Wray is someone who has a lot of respect on both sides of the aisle for his independence. He's seen as bipartisan. People believe that he will be able to draw more of a distance between himself and the president in some ways. Comey didn't do himself any favors by meeting with the president in the first place, by being a little bit pally with him when he first took office. Obviously, their relationship took a dramatic turn over the investigation into Russia. But the question really will be, I think, for Christopher Wray, can he deal with a president who has shown that he does not respect the independence of the FBI and that he wants the FBI director to report directly to him?
Has Ray said anything about how he views Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is in charge of investigating the Russia and alleged ties with Trump?
Well, in his Senate confirmation hearing, there was an effort by Christopher Ray to really cast himself as being independent. And he said, and he has said, that he believes that the quote was that the relationship between any FBI director and any president needs to be a professional one, not a social one. Now, I don't think that he was necessarily taking a dig at Comey. Comey is someone who was also well-respected. But for Comey to have even taken the dinner meeting with Trump that proved fateful and came up after Comey was fired, that was probably a mistake in retrospect. And I think that Christopher Wray has at least an example he can look toward and learn from Comey's experience that he's going to have to find a way to keep a distance from Trump. But he was very, very clear to say that he, in his confirmation hearing, that he would not see himself as being subservient in any way to the president, and that he would take very seriously the FBI's investigation into Russia. And you also do have some degree of cover now that you have a special counsel like Robert Mueller, who has been appointed. That's something that James Comey didn't have to fall back on when the president was, in fact, asking him to drop the investigation into Michael Flynn and parts of the Russian investigation. Someone like Christopher Wray can directly go to the special counsel Robert Mueller, and then you have, again, you would have a clear-cut case of obstruction of justice.
We're talking right now with Sabrina Siddiqui about some of the top stories this week out of Washington. She's a political reporter for Guardian U.S.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. What's your reaction to the president's involvement in crafting his son's misleading statement on his meeting with a Russian lawyer? Are you concerned about the Trump administration having ties to Russia? What do you think of the new FBI director, Christopher Wray, and what do you hope for his tenure? And you can also share your thoughts on renewed calls for the U.S.-Mexico border wall. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation, maybe hear from you, after the break on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking about the top stories from Washington, D.C. right now. Sabrina Siddiqui is with us. She's political reporter for Guardian U.S.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. After recent news, are you concerned about potential ties between Team Trump and the Kremlin? What do you think of calls from Speaker Paul Ryan to build a U.S.-Mexico wall? Do you think that the U.S. should spend the estimated $25 billion needed to build it? And what is your reaction to President Trump's suggestion that law enforcement should be rougher with suspects? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Sabrina, Paul Ryan has revived the Trump campaign promise of building a wall between the United States and Mexico. And what's more, he's started in a video produced about that, where he visits the border and he's in different styles of conveyance, helicopter and horseback. And it's a piece of kind of exciting filmmaking. Have you seen that?
I have seen it. It was a little unexpected, I think, to some, given that Paul Ryan had previously been a little bit skeptical about whether or not Congress would fund this border wall. But from a messaging standpoint, he wants to portray Republicans in the House as being all in to support the president's agenda.
And here's a little bit from that film.
I had the opportunity to travel down to Texas, to go to the Rio Grande Valley and spend time with our Border Patrol. When you see what they're up against, it really gives you even greater respect for what they do. They clearly need more tools and more support to do their jobs effectively. That's why we're going to get this done this week.
And the close there, something like, we need this wall. I mean, is this, as you said, unexpected? The wall idea is not very popular, including among Republicans. Mexico has flat out said it will not pay for the wall. The cost is pretty large, and even Republicans in border states aren't sure they want it. So what is at play here with Ryan supporting the wall?
Well, I think that the issue here is that the president has been very clear that the border wall remains one of his priorities. And if you're Paul Ryan and you're focusing not only on getting the president's signature on a budget and on other legislative priorities for Republicans in Congress, but you also want to be able to have your members go back to their districts, go back home to constituents, especially leading up to 2018, and be able to show that they've been supportive of the president and his agenda, especially what he campaigned on, then you do need to find ways to, at least from a messaging standpoint, show your support, even for something that may not be as popular with Republicans on Capitol Hill as it is with the president. It is true, though, I think he'll face an uphill battle getting the votes to actually fund the wall, because conservative Republicans are likely to look at that price tag and say, you know, that we should not be paying this amount of money. Certainly conservatives in the House are not the ones who pledged that Mexico would pay for it, which we know won't happen. Democrats are obviously going to block any spending bill. I think that includes money for the wall. So it really becomes a question of whether or not this is something that we actually see in a bill that passes Congress. And I certainly think that that's highly unlikely. And again, you know, as we saw with healthcare, something, even if it did pass the House, even if Paul Ryan mustered enough votes, the Senate is a very different ballgame. You have a lot, you have even fewer Republicans in the Senate, I think, who would support a proposal that allocates significant money toward this border wall.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Gary joining us first in Waukesha. Gary, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to weigh in on?
Well, I can weigh in on lots of things. Probably the most important one is the wall. We've got an opioid epidemic in the United States of America. People are dying. People are overdosing. And 80% of that supply is coming through the Mexican border. And we're only getting about 10% of what's coming through. So something needs to be done if we don't want to invest in Narcan and keep trying to keep people alive.
Gary, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your thoughts there. And is the wall something that still has popular support, maybe among Trump supporters, maybe for different reasons, like Gary's pointing to the opioid epidemic there? Is there a groundswell of support at some level?
Well, I do think that there are constituents in the Republican base who want a wall, but it's not just, you know, the Republican base that believes that the border should be secure. So if you're taking this more broadly into the issues of drug trafficking and national security, then there is support in both parties and among the majority of the American public to find a way to secure the border. The question is, you know, whether people, how people view the border wall, which many people, in terms of what Trump campaigned on, and they look at some of the rhetoric that he espoused about immigrants, they see this as more of a symbolic anti-immigration gesture. And that's where I think you're going to see a lot of the political fight, with Democrats staking out the ground that, you know, the way that Trump framed this wall is part of a broader hardline stance against immigrants. But then, you know, it's important to note that members of Congress have long supported up to 700 miles of fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border. And Trump, interestingly enough, for the first time in this off-the-record that later became on-the-record chat with reporters aboard Air Force One a few weeks ago, suggested he would be open to fencing. So the other question will be, is this something that will be a question of semantics, where what you are ultimately seeing proposed is actually fencing, not a full-scale wall, not what Trump campaigned on, and will it just be sold as Trump acting upon one of his promises?
There's an interesting side note here. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin said, was quoted on this matter, saying he always thought the wall was more of a metaphor. So an interesting take to see how it's being perceived in different corners there. And Sabrina, I want to wind up with one more story here about Fox News. How did the White House end up involved in a controversy about a Fox News story on the death of a Democratic National Committee staffer named Seth Rich?
Well, the issue with that is, first and foremost, I just want to mention that there's been no evidence to support the notion that this Democratic National Committee staffer, Seth Rich, who was apparently a victim of a homicide in D.C. in 2016, that there was any connection to WikiLeaks or the DNC, and that's some of the conspiracy theories that have been publicized by Fox News. Now, you know, with the White House, we do know that they have been willing to dabble a bit in conspiracy theories, and there was apparently some indication that they believe that the storyline would be somewhat beneficial to Trump. A big proponent of that storyline has been Sean Hannity. You know, he was threatened with legal action by Seth Rich's family and has still gone on to talk about possible conspiracy theories. But I think the White House has been somewhat dismissive, other than to acknowledge that Sean Spicer, who of course resigned as press secretary a couple weeks ago, that he met with some of the characters or individuals, I should say, who have been involved in, you know, the legal battle over the storyline around Seth Rich, as well as the conspiracy theories. And so I won't get into too much detail because I know you have to close. But I think the White House has been trying to downplay the significance and say that they don't really know, you know, they're not sure what Trump really believed or believes about the Seth Rich story. I think that it just kind of fits into this broader idea of an administration that has been willing to entertain conspiracy theories and has a fixation on relitigating, you know, potential corruption in the, by Hillary Clinton, or claims of corruption by Hillary Clinton in the DNC, because they don't have a lot that they can publicly, I think, or they don't have a lot to show for their administration. And so that's been a constant theme.
And Sabrina, just a little bit of time here. What big stories are you looking at or developments in the next week?
Well, you never really know what to expect. I think one of the big questions right now is John Kelly, who is the secretary for the Department of Homeland Security. He replaced, of course, Reince Priebus as the chief of staff in this past week. Can he bring some sort of military discipline to the White House? You know, of course, the biggest obstacle is the president himself, who still tweets, and he's shown that he wants to be himself. Trump will be Trump. So that's one, I think, narrative that people want to see, is after this big personal shakeup, what is going to be the impact of John Kelly? The other question, the White House today prepared back the proposal to reduce legal immigration by half. And we're not talking about illegal immigration, which is what Trump campaigned against. This is legal immigration. It doesn't have a chance on Capitol Hill.
So it looks like another big week in Washington. Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That was Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for Guardian U.S. based in Washington, D.C.
Two venomous northern black widow spiders have been found and confirmed for the first time in Brown County, Wisconsin. Our next guest is part of the team that positively ID'd these spiders, and he said people shouldn't worry too much. Northern black widow spiders are rare to see, and their bites are even more rare.
And we want to hear from you on this. What kind of spiders are you seeing in your backyard or around your neighborhood right now? Do you have any questions about the spiders that you're seeing or about arachnids in general? You can call in with your questions and your spider stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post and share spider pictures over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike Draney joins us now. He's a professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay. And he joins us from our Green Bay studios. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be back.
So tell us, what role did you play in finding these northern black widows?
Well, some concerned homeowners actually found the spiders and took pictures of them and even captured them in jars.
Wow.
And sent the photos to me. And people are always sending me things that they think are black widows. And occasionally they are black widows, but then they tend to be the introduced species that, you know, the western or southern species that cannot survive up here. You know, they can't survive the winter. And so when I saw this northern one, I got kind of excited, and I went over and took this. She donated the spider to me for study. And so that's why I was able to confirm that it was indeed the native species, the northern black widow, Atrodectus variolus.
I didn't know there were that many different kinds of black widow spiders, because I saw the pictures of these guys, or at least one of them, and they seem pretty unmistakable. They've got these great big red dots on them.
Yeah, that's right. And Latrodectus, the genus, the widow genus, there's about 40 species around the world, and most of them do have kind of this black and red warning coloration that warns smart animals like us that they have this really painful neurotoxin. But in the United States, there's about three species that are native. There's sort of a northern, southern, and a western species. And then there's also, and there's a couple of others, like the one, a red one that lives in Florida. But there's an introduced one down in the deep south and in the southwest called the brown widow. So there's a number of species that people encounter, but pretty much just the one up here.
So why are they called black or brown widow spiders? What's the widow talking about?
The widow part has to do with their reproductive behavior, where oftentimes the females will eat their mates right after copulation, sometimes even during copulation. This happens because the males are so much smaller than the females. Not all of them do this. Not all of them do it all the time, but there are some species where the male just is pretty much obligatorily eaten by the female. So that's kind of interesting biology.
Not a very nice date, I would say.
That's right.
Just out of morbid curiosity, Mike, what happens if, you know, I get bitten by a black widow spider?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to realize you will absolutely know if you were bitten by a black widow spider, because it's very painful. It's a neurotoxin that causes a lot of pain, and it spreads from the site of the bite. It also causes muscle contraction, sort of involuntary muscle contraction, spasming and cramping. And so in general, I would characterize, I've never been bitten, but it seems like a very miserable time, although very few people die of black widow envenomation.
And how often does it happen in Wisconsin, for instance, that someone actually gets bitten by a black widow?
There's actually no documented cases of anyone being bitten by a black widow in the state of Wisconsin. It doesn't mean it's never happened, but it's a very rare event. It happens probably a handful of people in southern states that have, where there are many, many black widows. And just to give you an example, where I grew up in New Mexico, in my backyard in Las Cruces, I could probably find a couple of dozen black widows in almost any day of the year.
Wow.
And so people live with hundreds of black widows in their environment, and yet few people are ever bitten. So the chance of you getting bitten in Wisconsin, where someone like me, I've been collecting spiders for nearly 20 years in Wisconsin. I've collected thousands and thousands of spiders, and I have never collected one myself. So they're fairly rare still.
Now, black widow spiders, they have a name. They're kind of famous or notorious. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other spiders that live in Wisconsin, you know, that we don't know the names of. I was recently reading about the brown recluse not too long ago. What other spiders like that should we be aware of that might be a little more common?
Well, in terms of like medically important species, there's really nothing else to worry about. There are a few cases of brown recluses moving into houses from other parts of the country in Wisconsin. For the most part, brown recluses don't seem to be able to survive the winter, even in our heated homes, because it seems like it's too dry for them and they dry up and die. All the other species are more or less harmless, although some of them can bite. And some of the ones that can bite you, it might hurt, like a wasp sting or a bee sting. But there really are no other medically important species of spiders in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Mike Draney right now. He's a professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay. And we are talking spiders. And Mike, I want to say I'm a big spider fan and I'm not afraid of them. I enjoy them.
Great.
You know, tell us. Thank you. Tell us about some of the great things that spiders do, why we should be happy when we see spiders around.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to remember that they are a part of our natural biodiversity. They're a part of the organisms that share this planet with us. And they're actually a pretty big chunk of biodiversity. They're the largest group of animals that consists entirely of predators. And there are over 500 species. We're not sure quite how many species live in Wisconsin, but at least 500 species live in Wisconsin. There are at least 46,000 species that live around the world. And altogether, I think probably the most important thing for just people in general is that they eat a huge number of insects, many of which bother us, eat our food, and so on. Someone has calculated a rough estimate that all the spiders on the planet eat about as many insects as the weight of all the people on the planet. So if you took all the 7 billion people and, you know, added that weight together, that's about how many insects they eat every year.
Wow.
And so they have a huge impact on our ecosystem and essentially are a stabilizing influence, and they result in fewer creepy crawlies. So what's not to like?
Let's take a caller now. We've got Deb joining us in Sheboygan. Deb, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I have a very interesting story that occurred this last weekend to my husband, who was kayaking on the river in Sheboygan. And he had just gotten into his kayak, and a friend of his stopped him and said, hey, come back here real quick. You got something on your back. He turned around, and he pulled off about a 3 to 4 inch large spider.
Wow.
That is huge. And my husband, if it was me, I would have freaked. My husband said, wow, that is so cool, and the guy threw it. But we wish we would have saved it because we're not sure if it's a mouse spider. But in some of the research, we found out that particularly this spider usually goes after tadpoles or other things. So you can imagine how shocking this was. But I just want to get your feedback on that.
Interesting, Deb. Do you have any thoughts about that, Mike?
Yeah, I do. It's very likely to be a fishing spider. It's a genus called Dolomedes. They're kind of related to the wolf spiders that you see running around, but they're pretty large. They can be pretty large spiders, and they tend to be associated with aquatic habitats. Many of them will sort of hunt by using the water as a web. They put their front legs on the surface of the water, and they can feel vibrations of creatures moving underneath the water, and they can sort of climb into the water. They can't really swim, but they can kind of crawl on the bottom. And they mostly eat insects, but it's true they've been documented as eating tadpoles and even minnows. They're harmless. They're big enough, of course, to bite you if you picked it up the wrong way, but they're harmless. And I think that they would be a great candidate for the state spider of Wisconsin.
We have a state
fishes,
everything
likes
else.
Water.
We need a spider.
Yeah, absolutely. So Thanks. Maybe some school kids can get together on that.
And get a campaign going. Thanks for that call, Deb, at 800-642-1234. Mike, I know a lot of plants and other species of animals, insects, birds have been affected by climate change, and their ranges have changed because of warming and the winters not being as severe. Do we know if there are spiders that we are now finding in Wisconsin that maybe were in more southern climates before?
Yeah, I'm definitely monitoring that. I'm interested in that question as well. One thing that we are seeing from other research, not my research, but other research has shown that for a lot of insects, the spiders are moving northward at the southern end of their range, but they're not moving northward at the northern end of their range. And so what's happening is their range is getting smaller. And that might, in fact, be what's going on. I'm not seeing a lot of spiders, a lot of new species from the south moving into Wisconsin. Really, I'm not seeing any of that. But one thing that might be happening is some spiders that are at the very northern edge of their range, like the northern widow, might be becoming more abundant as the climate becomes more favorable for their survival over the winter.
Right now, we're talking to spider expert Mike Draney from UW-Green Bay, and we're talking about, among other things, news that two northern black widow spiders were identified for the first time in Brown County.
And we're talking about all other things spider-related as well, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about spiders? How do you feel about them? Love them? Hate them? Just stay away from them? What kind of spiders are you seeing in your neighborhood now? Call in and share your spider stories and questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post pictures or share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and take more of your spidey calls in just a little bit. Stay with us on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now, we're picking up our conversation about spiders with Mike Draney from UW-Green Bay.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. You can call in and describe what spiders you're seeing to our spider expert. He can answer any questions you have about spiders or spider behavior. Do you love them, hate them, just want them to stay away? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post pictures of spiders on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to another caller right now. We've got Dan with us next, calling from Chippewa Falls. Dan, hi.
Hello. Say, I've recently found and photographed a marbled orb weaver, and that was never seen one before. It's very unique. And then I'm familiar with those fishing spiders, and I always thought they were a wolf spider They hang out by the water on the dock and on the boat lift. And then just a couple weeks ago, I found the most unique caterpillar I've ever seen. It had a face on it, and it had a forked tongue, and it was about the size of your thumb. And I have not identified that one yet.
Huh. So, well, you've been seeing a lot of cool stuff, Dan. And we have a picture up here in the studio of the marbled orb weaver, I think it is. It's pretty beautiful, I have to say. It's not kind of what you expect for creepy crawlies. It's sort of decorative.
That's right. That's what hence the name. It kind of looks marbled. It's a native spider, and it gets to be quite large, so people start noticing them. They start off in the summer. They're small, and they make their web very low in the vegetation, but they keep building it higher and higher as they get bigger. And so by the time you get to August, September, people start really noticing them. So that's one of the sort of Halloween spiders that people start to notice in the late summer.
And Mike, Dan from Chippewa Falls had an interesting point. A lot of homeowners say that there are lots of spiders near their lake houses. Does that match up with your experience and what we know about preferred spider habitat?
Yeah, to some extent, yeah. I mean, the lakes are going to be producing a lot of aquatic insects that emerge and fly away, right? Especially midges. And so this constant input of these aquatic insects into the terrestrial environment is just a great place for spiders to be intercepting those animals. And so some spiders are even sort of specialized in that. There's long-jawed orb weavers that they make a spiral orb web, but they make it horizontal because it intercepts emerging insects that are coming out of the water, and they often build their web over water. And so there are many spiders that will build up to be more common, more abundant on people's houses and docks and things near the water.
And speaking of webs, Mike, we learned something interesting getting ready for the show today. Apparently spiders eat their webs and start over when there is, for instance, a storm coming. Is that right? Do all spiders eat their own webs?
Not all of them, but the ones that make the nice spiral orb web, it's a fairly minimalistic structure, and most of those spiders will take it down every day and then put up a new one every day. It takes about an hour to do that. And so they get a fresh web, and when they take their web down, they ball it up into a little ball and eat it. And it's made of protein, and so they recover the amino acids so they can make some more silk later.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Let's go back to the phones, and Corrine in Waupaca is up. Hi, Corrine.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
I was wondering, how do you get rid of a spider phobia?
Do you feel like you have one, Corrine?
I know I have one.
All right. Well, I'm sure this is something, Mike, that you have come across. What would you recommend to someone who has what they realize might be an irrational fear of spiders?
Yeah, well, first I just have to tell her that, you know, she's definitely not alone, and that it's a sort of a natural thing, I might say, because when people have studied this, it's not related to a particular culture. All around the world in all different cultures, something like 10% of people seem to have this heightened fear of spiders, which sometimes can be brought about by a negative experience. About the only advice I would have to people is to learn about spiders. I think the more you realize that they're just part of our natural world and they're in fact not out to get us, they, like across the board, they're not out to get us. That's not what they do. I think it would make you a little bit more comfortable with them. But other than that, I'm not a psychologist, so it's not really my field.
Mike Draney's with us right now, professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay, talking spiders with us right now. It's summer. It's peak spider season. Mm-hmm. One of our producers is even going on spider walks to try to see spiders, and I've actually started noticing them more too. And, you know, they are beautiful, and the webs are definitely something to admire. Let's go back to another caller now, and you can join us if you've got a spider story, spider appreciation, or anything else to share about spiders. 800-642-1234 is the number, and Mike is next in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a story that it's kind of a medical mystery. There may be a spider involved. Maybe you can help me clear this up. About a month ago, I noticed a small welt on the inside of my left forearm, maybe less than half an inch in diameter, kind of felt like a small bruise. And within 8 hours, I was in an emergency room. The bruise had grown to an inch and a quarter in diameter and puffed up, you know, filled with clear liquid, and I had a 103.3 fever. and ended up spending 3 days in the hospital on all kinds of antibiotics, and they're running all kinds of tests to try and figure out what it was. About a week after I got home, I actually saw a small spider in my bed. It was not a black widow. I've used to live in Southern California, so I'm well acquainted with those. Very fast, managed to catch it, got some pictures of it. I'm just trying to figure out what in the world happened so that I can avoid it happening again.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any possibility? I know I heard you talking earlier, it's very, very unlikely for someone to have a medical problem from a spider bite here in Wisconsin, but something bit me, and I had a really bad reaction to it.
So it may or may not have been a spider. Interesting, Mike. And Mike, do you have any thoughts or diagnoses for Mike there?
As far as the spider bites go, your symptoms are not consistent with any spider, pretty much period, and certainly no spider that lives in this area. So the couple things. One is if you get bit by a spider, in general, you're very well aware of it. It's like no one ever says, I wonder if I got stung by a wasp yesterday. It's because if you get stung by a wasp, it really hurts, and then you look down, and there's a wasp stinging you. And that's the way it is usually with spiders, too, that they have painful bites. The other thing is that spiders are not very likely to bite you when you're sleeping or anything. Not that it never happens, but there's so many other animals that actually want to bite us and try to bite us and do, in fact, routinely bite us all the time. And so I'm not sure why it is that when people see things, they tend to blame a spider when there's no other culprit.
Yeah.
Finding a spider in your bed is not really that unusual. Getting bitten by that spider would be unusual. So my guess is it's a bacterial infection that's very commonly misdiagnosed for spider bites.
Thanks for that call, Mike. And let's go to Bruce and Cable next. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, when I was a child of my brother, sister, and I, we were about 8, 10, 6 years old. My dad was an entomologist for the Milwaukee Museum, and he had a pet, or at least a captive, black widow spider in a little observation case about 6 by 4 by 2 inches with a glass window. And he'd let us, you know, hold it. And there was an access hole to put insects in there. I don't remember ever wanting to feed them, but apparently it was fed because we had them for quite a while. But I remember holding on and thinking, if this glass broke, I'd probably die. And so we were always very respectful of that that little critter.
Thanks for that call, Bruce. And, you know, there is something to be said, Mike, I think, for even insects that, you know, might be slightly dangerous, that, you know, there's a lot to respect and appreciate about them.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, just like a lot of people really want to have, you know, natural animals like wolves around, even though there's some danger there, but they are a native animal, and we're, you know, we should probably share the planet with all these other organisms. The black widow is actually quite reluctant to bite people, too. So there were some scientists who were trying to study the effects of the black widow venom back in the 50s, and they reported having great difficulty getting the spiders to bite them. Their first instinct is to play dead. They curl up in the little ball and play dead. So I've got one of the black widows still in my lab, and I'm not worried at all that it's going to bite me. There's no question about that.
And Mike, we just have less than a minute to go, but could you wind up by giving us a little spider appreciation? Tell us about one or two of your favorite Wisconsin spiders and why you love them.
where would I start? It's definitely spider season right now, and one thing I always think about is the web is like a fossil of their behavior. They make these beautiful structures out in nature that a human couldn't even do, and they've got a brain the size of a grain of pepper. And so it's really amazing to see those. They're sort of like, I think of them as enhancements to the environment rather than just something that's messy. So.
And Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Mike Draney, professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay, talking about spiders.
Some good news today for your inner artist, because today is National Coloring Book Day.
You know, when I was growing up, coloring books really were for kids, but today, adult coloring books are a huge trend. The website Heavy.com is even reporting that people are holding coloring book parties today to celebrate the day.
And I guess my invite to your party, Judith, must have gotten lost in the mail.
Well, you know, I had to keep it really small this year. Sorry, Veronica. Maybe you'll make the cut next year.
Ouch.
Well, you know, you and I both, we were talking about this, and I really like coloring. I was doing it before it was cool for adults. But the coloring books that are supposed to be for adults actually stress me out because they are so intricate, and I'm worried. I like my little patterns to be consistent, and it actually isn't as relaxing as it could be.
I am completely on your level. My daughter she picked out an adult coloring book of mandalas. They're beautiful, but she gets bored after she covers in three of the thousands of little particles of it, and then she leaves it to me.
Exactly. I like the kid ones because I don't have to worry about getting all my colors right. And there's a sense of accomplishment. We actually have a link up on the Central Time Facebook page to a variety of free coloring pages that you can print and color.
Hopefully they won't stress you out and you can enjoy your coloring on this National Coloring Book Day. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.